Welcome to Busting Walls, a Pennsylvania Department of Corrections podcast, where we break through the walls and fences of our facilities to provide listeners with a real look inside the field of corrections with one of the nation's top DOCs. And here's your host of Busting Walls, DOC Secretary John Wetzel.
Well, good morning and welcome, everybody. I'm so excited to have our victim advocate, Jen Storm, on Busting Walls today. Last week was Victims' Rights Week, and I just thought it was a great way for me to start this kind of new effort around putting a face on what we do and really making sure people have an understanding of what we do. And I couldn't start with a better place than the lady who some would say is a force of nature and is properly named. So with that, Jen, thanks for joining us.
Thank you. I'm very honored to be your first guest, and thank you for having me.
Yeah, it's awesome. So, Jen, let's start with, help us understand how you came to become a victim advocate. I know in my case, when I was 10 years old, I was aspiring, I think, to be an architect because I was kind of a Brady Bunch kid. So I certainly didn't aspire to work in corrections. Help us understand your journey to victim advocacy.
Sure. Well, 30 years ago, I was aspiring to be an anesthesiologist. And I think it's only because I discovered they were the highest paid in the medical field.
Nice.
And then I had this kind of horrific event unfold in my life, and I was raped. And it really just shattered me, and it changed everything that I thought I had once known. And so I kind of set off on this pretty destructive path because it was, you know, it was the 80s, and we didn't have victim advocates, and we didn't have the supportive services that we fortunately now have for victims. So I kind of went down a really tumultuous path, and I chose drugs and alcohol as a coping mechanism. And so I kind of spun around for 10 years, but not existing, just trying to get through each day without, you know, killing myself, to be quite frank. It was the pain was horrific. And drugs and alcohol, unfortunately, at the time, were the solution for me, you know, until they were no longer the solution. As we know with addiction, it often doesn't end well. You know, usually people end up in prison, they end up in institutions, or they die. And unfortunately, I almost had the latter happen in my life, but it survived. And I went on to get kind of clean and sober. And what I intuitively learned very quickly was that if I wanted to maintain sobriety and I wanted to have a different life, I needed to start unearthing all of the things that had happened to me. So all the trauma, all the abuse, I had to start kind of unpacking that, if you will. And so that kind of led me into a very different path, and I started to go to school at Penn State University, and I was originally going to go and be a drug and alcohol counselor because I thought I want to, you know, give back this amazing gift of sobriety that has been given to me. And then I was a victim of a crime again on campus, and then that's when I learned about victims' rights, and I had this victim advocate reach out to me, and I had no clue that these things even existed. So it kind of opened my eyes to this whole new world, and once I realized that this existed, I was hooked.
So, Jen, what
kind of set me on my path?
When the second time that you became a victim of a crime, what year was that?
It was in 2002.
Okay.
So it was during a really tumultuous time at Penn State, although, God, I think you could hearken to say the last 10 years have been a pretty tumultuous for Penn State. But there was a lot of racial tensions. There were a lot of death threats. And I had come out as gay on campus, and, you know, as you said, I'm a force of nature. I didn't come out slowly. I kind of, you know, came out blazing with a rainbow flag, and I was, you know, engaging in protests and rallies and vigils and trying to raise awareness. And so I then became a victim of a hate crime as well.
Wow. So let me, but yeah. It's interesting, and one of the things you said struck me is that the first time when you were 12, when you arguably needed the most service, this notion of victim advocacy wasn't even an option for you.
No, it was in the 80s, and so the rape crisis movement was just starting to kind of come into focus, but not to the extent where I didn't have a rape crisis advocate in the hospital with me. I didn't have an advocate at court. All of those things kind of unfolded years later, and now, thankfully, you know, we have an abundance of services for kids and for victims who are going through the system. But yeah, my family and I didn't have anything.
Wow. So let's kind of juxtapose that with today. So I'm going to guess it's 2014, Governor Corbett appointed you to be the state's victim advocate.
Yep. It was 2013, actually. Yes. Yep.
Okay. So tell us about what that role is. what, and I think let's start with, I think sometimes people assume that the Office of Victim Advocate is part of the parole board. I think others assume it's part of corrections, when in fact, it's not either, correct?
Mm-hmm. Yes. So in 1985, Governor then Ridge, Tom Ridge, held this special session on crime, and one of the things that they really took a look at was the absence of post-conviction victims' rights. And so the creation of the Office of Victim Advocate, along with the statutorily mandated independent victim advocate, came into law. And so, yes, most people don't realize that the victim advocate is independently appointed, confirmed by the Senate, and it's a six-year term. We are only two states in the whole country that have the strength of legislation like that for a victim advocate. So it's a great model. It truly allows the person that holds this position to really be independent and be the voice of the victim. We do have wonderful working relationships with the Department of Corrections and the Board of Probation and Parole, because that's where so many of the post-conviction rights lie. And so certainly we have wonderful relationships, and we do a lot of programming together, but truly the office is independent.
Well, and one of the things that I think makes your job next to impossible is to be a voice for victims. The underlying assumption is that all victims are the same. Mm-hmm. And I think in the paint-by-number world, I think we make that assumption. Talk a little bit about how, I'm talking about the global advocacy point of your job or aspect of your job. And then after that, we'll transition more to the specific services. But so how do you speak for victims when victims are so, so different?
Yeah. And I think what you said, like, nothing could be further from the truth, right? Every single person who has experienced a violation or a victimization experiences that uniquely. And so I would never walk up to another rape victim and assume that we had the same experience. And I think, unfortunately, historically, our movement has done that, right? Our domestic violence programs and our sexual assault programs have been very kind of zero focused in on just kind of the protection and the safety and the security of the victim, and have kind of predicated policy on this notion that one size fits all. And I think over the past 5 years or so, we've really started to shatter that notion and start to understand that every victim experiences the situation differently, and every victim has different expectations. Some want justice, right? Some want to go through the criminal justice system. Others absolutely do not. And so we have to really tailor our services to meet the needs of, you know, very diverse population, right? And then we also have to build shaped policy and build good practices around serving the majority of the victims. So there are times when we have to speak to the extent that we can with the voice of the victims. And so within my office and within my role, I try to be very careful. You'll never see me speak in the media regarding a case or regarding a victimization unless I have authorization and have been asked from that victim to do so. I'm very careful with that. If when I've been asked to speak kind of broadly on an issue, I make sure I do my homework and I do my research. And within our office, that means we do surveys out to our population. You know, we try to get a good pulse as to what are the majority of the victims that we are serving today, how do they feel about this particular topic. So when the issues of juvenile lifers came down, you know, we were doing all kinds of notifications out to our registered victims who we were working with. And then we started to do surveys so that we actually had good data, so that when I was getting called from the media, I was, you know, at least putting forth what I felt comfortable was the majority of the opinions. But then I would always make sure that the minority was also highlighted, because we want to do the best to try to encompass all of the range of emotions and feelings and issues. Hard, very hard.
Yeah, and as we transition into talking about specific services, what really struck me again was that 12-year-old girl that you were, that just didn't know where to turn and turned in not a good place, shall we say, and what we know about our inmate population is the addiction, the trauma that's unresolved. And so what really just struck me is that the services that you all provide certainly are focused around making victims and survivors whole, but also have this potential to get people back on track when that track could lead, as you said earlier, to jail or death. So why don't start talking about some of the specific services that you all provide?
Sure. So So at the Office of Victim Advocate, we provide a lot of notifications, right? So we want to make sure that anytime, and we get involved, let me make this kind of make it clear, because it does get confusing. We have amazing victim services in all 67 counties of Pennsylvania. Some counties might have 4 to 5 organizations, another county might have 1, but every county has services. What we do is we kind of pick up those services at the time of sentencing if the offender is sentenced either to a term of state incarceration or if they're put on state probation or parole. And then that's when our office, kind of the victim's rights, if you will, divert to our office. And then we get engaged. So we first and foremost want to make sure victims understand what their rights are, because so often victims have no idea that they even have rights and then they don't know how to execute them. So we make sure that they understand that. And then we start talking with them about how to engage those. So how do you provide meaningful input? How do you engage this kind of process where at some point you're going to have to deal with the offender coming out, right? Because we know the majority of our inmates are going to be released and they're going to come back out into the community. So we are working on trying to, how do we thoughtfully inform our survivors and our victims about ways to provide input, but also, and you and I have spoken about this at length, also making sure that the victim or the survivor that we're working with has enough information to make that informed decision. So we want our survivors to be empowered with, you know, what has this individual done while they've been incarcerated or under supervision? Have they engaged in programming? Have they meaningfully changed? Have they taken advantage of some of our programming, like our Impact of Crime class? Have they done an inmate apology letter? So we've really worked on strengthening the communication that we can provide to survivors so that when parole is coming up, they're making an informed decision, and it's, you know, hopefully they're not looking at the person who committed the crime, but they're looking at this changed person, right? We hope that's the goal. I think it's your goal, it's my goal. And so we have a lot of programming that we can thoughtfully engage the offenders. So we do our inmate apology bank, which is simply just that. We have the opportunity for any inmate who wishes to write a meaningful and thoughtful letter of apology to their victim. They have the ability to do that. They submit it to our office. We screen it, and then we provide it to the victim if the victim so chooses. We take it a little one step further where we have a victim offender dialogue program. We were one of the first in the nation to do this, and that's where we actually will have a meaningful conversation face-to-face between the victim and the offender. It's solely victim-initiated. The offender has to be willing, has to agree, has to obviously take some degree of accountability. We want to make sure it's a healthy, therapeutic conversation. We also do Impact of Crime classes that inmates are able to sign up for, so they have to take the initiative to do this. And thankfully, we do this in all 26 institutions, and we always have a wait list of individuals who want to take this. And we bring survivors into the institutions, and they share their experience, strength, and hope. And I'll tell you, our survivors love that we have a good group of survivors who absolutely love coming into the institutions and trying to impact the inmates that they know are coming back into the community, because they understand that rehabilitation is vital, and they know that, you know, they might have been harmed, but they want to make sure no one else has ever been harmed again by that person. So we have a really group of solid survivors who do that.
So Jen, talk a little bit about what that actual, that has to be an intense interaction. Where a survivor coming inside a prison, which is a harsh environment. I mean, when you hear those doors slam behind you, mm-hmm. it's a different sound. Now, it's not as scary as the door slamming behind you when you walk into the Capitol, but exactly. But it's close. give our listeners an insight into what that interaction looks like.
It's incredibly intense. It's incredibly powerful. We have amazing trained facilitators from all disciplines, all across the Commonwealth, who help us make this happen. It's not something that, you know, somebody says, oh, I want to do a dialogue, and then we're in the prison doing the dialogue the next day. It usually takes 6 months to a year to prepare the victim and prepare the offender. So we do a tremendous amount of therapeutic work with both of them. We want to manage expectations. We want to make sure that, to the best of our ability, the conversation is therapeutic, it is healing. And then when it does come down to that face-to-face conversation, it is incredibly powerful. And oftentimes it can lead to forgiveness. For some survivors, though, forgiveness is not an option, but it can certainly provide some answers, maybe some healing. We had a documentary done on this program. It's called Beyond Conviction. So anyone interested in kind of watching a couple of our dialogues, there's 3 that are highlighted in that documentary. You just have to Google Beyond Conviction. It's incredibly powerful.
Jen, let me ask you this. If there's somebody who has been a victim or a survivor of a crime and the individual who did that to them is in a state prison or on state parole today, how would they sign up? How would they become registered with your office so they can get these important services? I mean, the notification of when somebody's coming out, that's a huge deal.
Yes, absolutely.
So how would they do that?
So they can go to our website, which is just simply ova.pa.gov. They can call 717-214-2256 and speak to an advocate and get registered that way. But our website will take them through every single service we provide. It'll provide them with a registration form, and then they can just send that to us right through our website, which is, you know, really easy if they're not yet ready to pick up the phone, but they know they want to start receiving some notifications from us.
Yeah, but and also they could just pick up the phone too, and you have a phone number on there, and your staff is trained in these matters, and because I imagine that making that phone call for some would be very scary.
It is, certainly, you know, and for some it's fascinating. Oftentimes we'll have individuals register with us who never engaged in services at the local level because they just for whatever reason weren't there yet, they weren't ready. So it certainly can be very scary. It's just like picking up that phone to get any other assistance that you can imagine, right? Drug and alcohol, mental health, victim services oftentimes encompasses all of those realms. And so it is a big step when somebody, you know, picks up the phone or fills out that application and kind of submits to us. And we appreciate that.
And how many victims and survivors does your department represent right now?
Right now we're serving 42,000 victims. And one of my primary goals when I came into this position in 2013 was to increase the awareness of our services. At that time, we had only 28,000 victims registered.
Wow.
So I'm really proud that we're, you know, really starting to increase our numbers. Because if you don't know, you don't know. And like Maya Angelou always says, until you know better, you do better. And so my big, big goal is just get the awareness out. So thank you for having me on the show, because I think for sure someone's going to hear this that had never known about our services before, and hopefully they're going to call us and they're going to learn that they have all these rights that they can engage. And so I appreciate that.
Yeah. So, but for these 42,000 victims and survivors, how many staff do you have to manage all of this? I mean, we spent the last 15 minutes just hearing about all these great services. Mm-hmm. How many staff do you have to deliver all this service?
Including myself, we have 22. We're one of the smallest agencies in the Commonwealth.
Wow.
Yeah.
And so, what's your budget?
So it's roughly, if we were fully funded, it would be right under $2.5 million. So again, rather small if you look at the overall makeup of the state agencies.
So I mean, but I think our listeners would agree. You'd be hard pressed to find an investment of that sort, $2.5 million, that impact the number of people that you impact. So, you know, we're in budget season. So before we get off here, how did you fare in the House budget that was passed last week?
Not too great. And I've been pretty vocal about it on social media.
Not you.
And I'm hoping it's just a misunderstanding. But unfortunately, the budget that was passed through the House last week would decrease us by $156,000, which doesn't sound like a lot of money, but for me it equates to two positions. So that would mean I would have to lay off at least two people, which would bring us down to 20 people serving 42,000 victims.
Well, I hope it's a misunderstanding too. I can't imagine a circumstance under which we'd cut victim services that would have that kind of impact. So one other program, Jen, I want to touch on before we wrap this up. And it's a really unique program. As a matter of fact, it's probably the only one like it in the country. And that's putting a victim advocate inside a prison to focus on inmates and staff who experience, who are either victimized, attacked, or in any other sort of way. Could you talk about that a little bit? Because it's a really interesting concept.
Yes, and it was really exciting, and I think it really, for me, it kind of came out of all of the PREA work that was being done, and, you know, Pennsylvania's done, I think, a phenomenal job at coming into compliance with PREA, and, you know, we work, obviously, with all victimization, so not just sexual violence, and it kind of struck me that, you know, we're doing all this great work for those who are being sexually violated in the prisons, but what about physical violence? And so often we forget about those who are physically violated, and so I remember coming to you and saying, hey, I've got this idea. what if we create an institutional victim assistance coordinator? That way this person is, you know, solely in the institution, and she or he is there to respond to any of the inmates who are victimized, and then also staff, because oftentimes we know that sometimes it's inmate on staff, staff on staff, staff on inmate. And so we wanted to make sure that there was at least a supportive person inside those walls that they felt safe with, that was confidential. You know, certainly there are wonderful psychological resources and counselors within the institution, but if, you know, if someone's being bullied or they're being harassed or they're being threatened and they're being harmed, you know, not everyone is totally willing to come forward and speak that to someone who might have to report it. Our office is fully confidential. So anything that's said to our victim assistance coordinator is said in confidence. And so, you know, we do have a female in that position. Her name is Heather. She's really there just to provide supportive services. If they are at a point where they want to report, she can help facilitate that report. She'll go to court with them. And we do, you know, inside the walls what we do on the outside. We also have a lot of victims of crime who are also serving time. So they may have cases that are going through the criminal justice system for their victimization case, and they need that accompaniment. They need that supportive service just like any other person would. And I firmly believe that providing that kind of holistic care inside the walls will hopefully help that person heal a little bit more, whereas if they were just treated like an inmate and they didn't have any of that supportive victim services like somebody on the outside would have, I think their experience would be different. And so I want to make sure that they feel just as important as a victim of crime as any other person would anywhere else in the state of Pennsylvania.
Yeah, that's awesome. And you know, as we've gone through this, the process of getting all our facilities certified in the Prison Rape Elimination Act, mm-hmm. and really working towards having safe facilities. And as you acknowledged earlier, you know, with 90% of everybody who's sitting inside a state prison today getting out, it's incumbent upon us to have people get out less likely to commit a crime. And that's an area where I think we all agree. So, Jen, I'm going to wrap this up. I want to thank you for taking this maiden voyage with me. Is there anything else you'd like to say on your way out the door?
Yes, I just want to thank you, because without you and your dedication and your leadership and your unique understanding of the importance of victim services, we wouldn't be able to do half of the work that we do in the institutions. And I appreciate you making it a priority, because your leadership is vital. And without that, we might not be able to have this institutional victim assistance coordinator. We wouldn't have, you know, the impact of crime class being mandated in all 26 institutions. And I also want to note quickly, every single institution did not just one, but multiple awareness creating events for National Victims' Rights Week, and it was beyond humbling. And we are the only state in the whole country that had every institution do something, and that's a testament to your leadership. So I just thank you.
Yeah, and you know, the intro here says one of the best Department of Corrections in the country, and I truly believe that we have the best victim advocate and victim advocate department in the country, and Pennsylvanians are very fortunate for the big bang they get from your little budget, and hopefully we'll get a little more sanity in the House, in the Senate, around the budget, and certainly an understanding of the serious impact that cuts like that could have moving forward.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Bye.